This is Richard Perrone, and I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. John Hargesheimer. Today is June 16th, 2003. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Mr. Hargesheimer is in Sellersburg, Indiana, and it's approximately 8:33 a.m. Central Standard Time. Mr. Hargesheimer, we left off around July 68. You had left Khe Sanh. You went to Cam Lo for a few days, then to Dong Ha, and where I think you got in a fight. That's correct, right? And then you were transferred to Quang Tri, which was kind of your home base. And from there, you went out into the field and performed various missions, various jobs. Let's pick up there. Tell me what kind of jobs and missions that you were sent out on to do.
Well, basically, I was a weapons repairman, so I would go out and check the 106s and just make sure that the weapons, the sidearm weapons that they carried, were in good shape and stuff like that. And I was basically on call. Mm-hmm. So,
would you go out alone, or would you go out with other people?
No, I would. I would go out by myself, but they would. I'd catch a convoy out to wherever they were, or a helicopter, or wherever they needed. And then I was always with other people once I got there.
Okay.
But usually I was by myself.
Okay.
So it was really, I enjoyed it because I just got me out of the rear, and I didn't like that at all.
Why not?
There's a lot of petty stuff. Too much. They actually stood inspections and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You had to look really sharp, and you had to salute, and it just, which is okay, even the way it should be, but still, it wasn't as much freedom in the rear as you had out in the field. You just, you were on your own pretty much out in the field, and so it was a lot more enjoyable. I enjoyed the guys out there anyway.
Were you with your unit, the same men that you were at Khe Sanh when you were at Quang Tri?
Pretty much so. Some of the guys had rotated out, but you were always with the Antos guys. And
right.
For the most part, there was guys you always knew. You usually met the people you knew all the time. So it was. I got to know them quite well, and it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed their company.
Okay. Tell me about some of the things that you went out in the field to do. You said you were repairing weapons. Let me ask you this. Did you find that the folks in the field had the supplies, the weaponry that they needed, that they had requested?
Yeah. It was better once you got out of Khe Sanh. The supplies were easier to come by. Khe Sanh was just you were pretty well isolated. But out in the field, you could get parts easier. If you had to, you could go to another outfit. There's usually another outfit somewhere close by, and you could scrounge parts, trade parts, stuff like that. So you pretty well worked on your own. And I had tools and stuff, so it wasn't that bad.
Are there any incidents that you remember that come to mind about this time period?
Various things. I remember being down on the... There was a bridge. They were building a bridge right outside of Camp Curl. I forget the name of the bridge they were building. The Seabees were building it, and we had gone down there. The Marines were down there pulling protection. We were pulling protection for the Seabees, and so they were working on the bridge. The enemy at NVA or Viet Cong had blown the bridge, so they were working on that. And it was pretty interesting. One night, I think I was laying there. I went down there with them and working on it, and they got hit one night. And it was kind of interesting. They were coming up over the edge of the. It was almost like something out of a movie. They were in a field. We were up on a little high plateau, a little flat area, and there were some trucks, big dump trucks, laying there, and. The enemy was out in the field in like a real tall elephant grass, and they were down there, and all of a sudden they started lobbing in mortars or rifle grenades, one of the two. I think it was small mortars or rifle grenades because it wasn't the big stuff. And we were laying there, and I was sleeping underneath a dump truck, one of the dump trucks. And they started lobbing some either rifle grenades or small mortars in, and of course it got everybody's attention real fast. And the enemy had NVA had infiltrated that elephant grass, and they had gotten in the river, and they were floating down to the down to where we were, and they were climbing up basically a cliff, a real And they were coming over, and they were going to come up over the edge. And it was almost like a suicide mission, really, for them. And so I do remember one of the rounds came in. I was laying underneath there, and it landed in the bed of the truck I was laying underneath. And luckily, I guess it was a small round, or it must have been a rifle grenade. Mm-hmm. And it just, like somebody stuck your head in a trash can and just beat on it, because it was just extremely loud. That's the way he woke up.
Right.
So then, you know, you snapped out of that, and your head was throbbing on that one. And, of course, then all chaos was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon, and there was, the way it was, there was Marines up in this was at the rock bow, basically, mm-hmm. at the edge of the rock bow.
Right.
And there was a lot of Marines up there, just little pockets all around the rock bow.
Mm-hmm.
And they started shooting down at them. Of course, mortars were going off, so you could see flares were going off, so you could see what was coming off, what was happening. And, the Marines were shooting down at them from the rock bow. And then we started, when they come over the edge of the cliff there, the top part, it was just like sitting ducks. It was just unbelievable. And you just shoot them. And it got so bad, there were so many NVA Viet Cong floating around in the river down there, that just down from us, there was a lot of rocks, and it was like a little funnel in the river.
Mm-hmm.
And the NVA, there were so many NVA bodies there, they were just jamming up the... They couldn't make it through the slot,
mm-hmm.
basically. And that lasted for a little while, probably about an hour or so. It didn't last really that long. But it was the next day, we were looking over the edge of the cliff, the edge there, and you just see all these bodies laying there,
mm-hmm.
you know, jammed up in there. So the engineers went down there and just set charges on them and blew them up.
Oh, really? Okay. Was there any effort to recover the bodies and search for intelligence?
Well, yeah, they looked at them and stuff like that, but for the most part, they just blew them up.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of interesting. And we had, earlier that day, we didn't have hardly any grenades left because we had gone fishing with them.
Okay.
You know, we used the grenades to fish with because we didn't think we was goofing off, basically, and we was throwing grenades in the river and catching fish that way, blowing them up, and then they come up, and the guys would be down there at that opening,
mm-hmm.
that slot, and you know, you put a mosquito net down there, and you catch the fish.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, we sure wish we hadn't done that, because that night we needed the grenades.
right. Was that method of fishing approved by the officers? Did they have a problem with that?
No, they didn't. We didn't have officers with us.
Okay.
We had a sergeant. I can't remember his name. He was a big. I think he was a black guy. He was a good man. But it was pretty loose. The engineers or the CBs were pretty much in charge,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't worry about it, and we didn't worry about it. And no officer. They didn't like it, but they didn't say much to us.
Right. How much had your combat at Khe Sanh prepared you for combat away from Khe Sanh in the field? Like, how did you react that evening? Were you calmer than you think you would have been, or were you prepared?
Oh, yeah. It gets exciting, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And but by this time, you're so acclimated to split-second things that, once the chaos, and that doesn't last that long. It seems like it lasts a long time, but it doesn't. And you get your act together. It doesn't take long. You get excited, that's for sure.
Now, is that the only time that you experienced combat in this time period?
That was probably the last time I experienced combat, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was nothing major, you know, snipers and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of that, it was pretty calm after that.
How did the units that you were visiting to, when you're going out there to actually help them repair their weapons and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
how do they treat you coming in as kind of an outsider? Were you welcomed into their unit for the time period that you were there?
Yeah, I never had any problems with that. No. As long as you were in the Marine Corps, they didn't bother them.
Right.
And once they figured out you were okay, you know, everybody was a little leery of somebody. But I never had any problems with that. Some of the staff NCOs, they might, but nah, they never gave you a hard time. Because, of course, you were there to help them, so mm-hmm. they weren't going to give you a hard time.
What were the most common repairs that you were making?
Just the rock. rifles and pistols. Not the pistols so much. Those 45s were great pistols, I'd say. That. Was, they would last you forever. But I would just, you know, take them. I could field strip them, detail strip them. So sometimes I just kind of get pulled maintenance on them. Nothing major, but sometimes the 106s would get out of timing, stuff like that. Anything, the machine guns might not be working right, and so I'd go out there and, you know, just repair those.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting. I enjoyed it. And a lot of times, you know, it only take you, you know, 20 or 30 minutes to work on something.
Mm-hmm.
You had a day or two, so you just goofed off the rest time with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I usually stayed in the rear of the, on that part, the rear of the little base camp or something like that.
Mm-hmm. What's your opinion, since you work with the weapons so much with the American weapons, what's your opinion of the weaponry that we had there? Was it adequate for fighting in that kind of environment, or was there something that we did not have that you saw the men wanting to have?
I thought it was pretty good. Once the M16, once they got all the kinks out of the M16,
right,
it was a great rifle.
Right.
At first, you know, naturally it's terrible, but once everything got their act together, I couldn't complain about the weapons, especially from what considering what we had. I think the M14 was still a better rifle, but because it's just a heavier weapon, and you know, you could shoot to just so much more power.
Mm-hmm.
And but overall, no, I can't complain about the weapons. If they're working good, they're great.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you think that our use of force was adequate in Vietnam? As far as, you know, again, you're working with the weapons. Did we employ our weaponry adequately, do you think?
I think we did. As good as you could do in that kind of environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just so different. Sometimes you'd be in the flatlands, or if you were on the coast, you're on like the beaches or the rice paddies and stuff like that, and you're in the real thick foliage.
Mm-hmm.
But for considering what we had and the air power, considering level of the they did a good job. I
mm-hmm.
couldn't complain.
Okay.
Yeah. Now they made mistakes, so I know a lot of guys got several people got killed by friendly fire.
Mm-hmm.
And but that was the exception, not the rule.
Okay. Okay. Did you ever, once you got out of Khe Sanh, did you ever hear of any incidents of fragging or that kind of intense disagreements?
No. I know it happened, but I was never around any.
Okay, okay. Was life in the rear, when you were there, not going out on your
mm-hmm.
duties, on your jobs, how different was it from Khe Sanh? I mean, you said you didn't really like the rear too much.
No, I didn't like it, but it was about like a 9-to-5 job. You know, you got up and you went to chow and you went and did your job and
mm-hmm.
and came back and did your thing. You had guard duty that night sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you sat around, you know, after like, about 4 or 5 o'clock, whatever time it was, when you knocked off your job,
mm-hmm.
it was like I said, it was a 9-to-5 job. And then a lot of guys, if the club is open, a lot of guys go drink and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
and play basketball.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like the, it wasn't for me. If I'd have had, I spent a year and a half in the States before I went over,
mm-hmm.
almost a year and a half. If I'd have had that year and a half to do after I got back, I probably would have extended.
Really?
Yeah. And after knowing how it was in the States compared to Vietnam, Vietnam was much more, you know, is more dangerous,
mm-hmm.
but I just didn't like the, I hate to say chicken shit, but that's mm-hmm. basically what it was. I just didn't like the you know, spit and polish and all that stuff. It wasn't for me.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that your attitude was common amongst the men?
Yeah, most guys did not like the rear, or did not like the st- I knew a lot of guys when I was in the States.
Mm-hmm.
There were several guys that would come back from Vietnam, and they would be there just a few matter of weeks, and they would put in for going back to Vietnam. They put in for orders to back to Vietnam. Even though it was more dangerous, it's mentally, it really wasn't as bad in Vietnam as it was in the States. Now I don't know about other branches of service, but the Marine Corps is just spit and polish, and stuff like that, and they would mess with your minds, and they'd just, I loved the Marine Corps, but, you know, everybody loves the Marine Corps more after they're out than when they're in.
Right.
So.
Now, that, what you're describing, the psychological impact of being in Vietnam, and then being in Vietnam in the rear, and being back in the States, stateside, it'd be very difficult for somebody who wasn't there or wasn't in the military to really understand that mentality of wanting to actually go back into a more dangerous situation, but you felt more comfortable there.
Right. Yeah, you did. There's a lot more camaraderie, and there's just something about, yeah, I just enjoyed it more. You know, terrible as it was, I wouldn't want to, you know, it was a love-hate situation. You hated part of it, most of it, but there's just something about it that you definitely, you know, it was better to me than. Now, it would have really depended on where you got stationed, too. But I had been at Camp Lejeune for over a year, and I was ready for Vietnam after that.
Right, right. Tell me about the Vietnamese civilians and your interaction with the civilians, especially once you got back away from Khe Sanh and you were traveling around the country. What was your impression of the Vietnamese civilians?
I never had any problem with them. I had a lot of respect for the Vietnamese civilians. And, you know, you go into villages and for the most part, it wasn't too bad. They treat you okay. The workers at the, as another thing, the workers on the bases in the rear, they were good. They didn't interact with you a whole lot, but you could goof off with them if they learned, enough English. But you're always kind of leery of them because, a lot of times they might be, you know, spotters or spies for the Viet Cong or NVA. So that happened every once in a while. You know, they'd have you'd find out that somebody that you'd seen forever on the base turned out to be a Viet Cong spy. So you always had to be leery like that. You never really knew who was good and who was bad. You just got to trust some people after a while. But we never had a lot of Vietnamese workers. Now, there's some bases that just had them, you know, they employed them full-time, just like, you know, they come in and do all the work in the mess halls and stuff like that. I never was really around that that much that way. But I couldn't complain. They were good, hard-working people for the most part.
What was their attitude toward the Americans that you saw?
They didn't. It depended. They wanted your money, but... And for a lot of times they treat you okay, but for the most part they're pretty indifferent. They don't. I think most of the people had some family member that was a Viet Cong or something like that, so they were pretty sympathetic. You never really knew one way or the other how they felt towards you. I mean, sometimes you could just see the hostility in their eye, but it may be just the way you thought you were perceiving how they were, but. I never really had that much interaction with them on a personal basis, but you know, I've seen almost as many since I've gotten back and talked to more since I've gotten back than I did over there on a per one-to-one basis.
What's been your experience talking to them now and being around them backstage?
I have no problem with them. I think they're good, hardworking people. The ones that I've met did have an incident in D.C. one time, several years ago, and you know, the vendors on around D.C. they always have a trailer there, and they've got they're selling T-shirts and stuff. It seemed like, and I haven't been there for several years, but it seemed like a lot of them were Vietnamese. The vendors were Vietnamese. I was sitting there on a bench, and my wife and daughter were shopping like it at some of those vendors, and. One of the guys was Vietnamese right in front of me, and he was up in his trailer. And apparently he had been a Vietnamese officer, North or South Vietnamese officer. And so I had a T-shirt on, said something about Vietnam. And he looks at me, and pretty soon we're in a shouting match.
Really? Over what?
Well, he said, we deserted them, and we're the reason why South Vietnam lost the war and all that stuff. And I'm thinking, this is stupid. we kind of got in a shouting match there. You know, he was doing more of the shouting than I was, and I said, "This is, you know, sorry about your luck, buddy, but I'm good. You know, I didn't want to get too much involved in this,
mm-hmm.
but he was kind of a bitter person.
Mm-hmm.
He'd probably been a high up, and he had some age on him, so he had been probably high up.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, now from a life of good life to selling T-shirts in Washington D.C., probably quite a shock for him.
Mm-hmm. Was that the exception to your experience with the Vietnamese here?
That was the exception. I've never had another person ever say a bad word to me as far as the South Vietnamese go.
Tell me about Vietnam, the country itself. What was your impression of Vietnam?
Well, I thought it was a beautiful country, especially up around where we were up in the mountains. It was really pretty.
Mm-hmm.
The mountains were pretty because it reminded me of the Smoky Mountains, sort of like, you know, Tennessee and Kentucky in
mm-hmm.
that area. But then you get down south, or you get down on the flatter level, more towards the coast, and then it got to be, and there was a lot of jungle up in the mountains too, but then down in the flatter parts was more rice paddies. To me, it was just interesting,
mm-hmm.
just an interesting place, because it was so different from anything I was around.
Mm-hmm.
The country itself I thought was a beautiful country. It was so backward.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things that always amazed me. And it was just so backward and primitive. And so that was the thing I remember the most.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tell me, as we're getting closer to December 68, this is when you left country.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a short-timer's calendar? Were you keeping up with your exact time of your goal?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I was out in the, oh yeah, you always, and I got out a little early. I got out about 2 weeks early because I guess there's enough guys, you know, got wounded and killed and rotated, got medevaced out that they moved my date up. So I was there actually about 12 and a half months, and I was out, I can't remember where I was. I believe I was at Camlo or Contien, one of those places, and I got orders to come back in.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, you know, how the crap am I going to get back? And they didn't give you much notice. Like you had 2 or 3 days to get back, and that was it.
Mm-hmm. So you had to find your own way, basically.
Right, I had to find my own way. I hitchhiked, got out on the road and hitchhiked. And basically, I was hitchhiking back, and, you know, you're just hoping you get out of there before dark.
Wasn't that a tad dangerous?
Yeah, it was kind of. It was, yeah. That was the only way I could get out of there. I wanted out so bad. So, yeah, he just got out there and he caught rides.
Uh-huh.
And I caught a ride from, I believe it was Camlo. Yeah, I believe it was Camlo is where I was.
Uh-huh.
And I just got out on the road and got all my gear, threw it in the pack, and stood out on the road and stuck my thumb out.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, caught rides with CBs or some Marine convoy or some, you know, something like that. And I finally got back.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like it was, once again, it wasn't that far, but because it was the danger, it was, you know, you just couldn't be caught out there, especially at night. And it was probably maybe 20 or 30 miles at the most, and that may be stretching it, but it just took forever to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And you just caught right. I ended up with some CB on one of these big graders. I hopped on that, and, you know, he stuck me back in the belly part of the grader, and I'm bouncing around all beaten, just bouncing all over the place, but you just catch it here and there and go 5 miles down the road with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I made it back, and then once I finally got back, then we had to turn in all the gear. And that night, I still remember, there was a guy named Dennis Morgan that I grew up with, and if anybody would have, I would have thought, if anybody would not have been in the service, especially the Marine Corps, it would have been Dennis, because he was what we called, you know, for a little school where I was from, he was the closest thing to a hippie we had.
Mm-hmm.
And I would never have thought Dennis would have been one of the ones that go into service, well, like I say, especially the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was in the mess hall, and all of a sudden I look over there, and there's Dennis Morgan. Oh, my
mm-hmm.
God, I can't be right. But we went over and we started shooting and talking. And sure enough, it was Dennis, and he joined. Couldn't mm-hmm. believe it. And I never seen him with normal hair or anything.
Mm-hmm.
All my time I knew him, because I knew him from about 12 years old up.
Mm-hmm.
And so we spent the evening, and we went to the movie there, and then that night, sure enough, I'd already turned in, no, I didn't turn in my rifle yet. I had cleaned it and everything, because you had to turn it in for inspection.
Mm-hmm.
And that night, we got a red alert. This was at Quang Tri. Mm-hmm. I was at Quang Tri, and we got this red alert. There's enemy in the water. So I had no idea what I was supposed to do, so they told me to hop on the back of this six-pack, and you went down this road, and they would tell you when to jump off. Mm-hmm. So like two, and they had little bunkers there for you to man.
This is your last night in country?
This is my last night up there. I had one more night in country after I left there.
Okay.
And so, you know, you hop down. You know, they tell you it's dark, it's pitch dark, and you're going down the back of the six-pack with an open bed. And they tell you to jump off, so I jump off, me and two or three other guys, and we're going to man this bunker. And sitting up on a little rise, had to go through the elephant grass, and it's on the perimeter. And I had no idea what the hell was coming off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sitting there. And so as was, then later on, some of this other guy was going to have a cigarette, so we went over to itch on the other side of the bunker, away from the perimeter, and we're laying there in the grass, smoking a cigarette, and all of a sudden you could feel this something underneath you, and it just kind of wiggled, and it was a snake. It was a good-sized snake, because it was under both of us, and we were probably a couple of feet apart.
You were laying on top of the snake.
Yeah, we had no idea. He was, apparently we were in his path, and he was just coming from one place to another, and he went underneath us. And, boy, I just, you know, God bless, I'm going to get bit by some poisonous snake my last night around this place, my two nights to go.
Right.
And, yeah, that may have been my last night. I'm not sure if that's my last night. I think it was. I flew from there. I flew to, the next day I flew to Dong Ha. Yeah. No, Da Nang. Flew to Da Nang and left. Mm-hmm. So it was my last night in country.
What did you do with the snake? Did you guys jump up or did you let it go?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. We didn't bother it at all. We jumped up and I think we squealed like little girls.
What kind of snake was it?
It scared me more than the NVA ever did. So we jumped and looked at each other and flipped those cigarettes and took off. We took off and went running up the side of the hill towards the bunker. Boy, that was like, I don't think I ever got it. And then about 3 o'clock in the morning, they called the alert off. No, I think it was, I don't know, it was probably some water buffalo out there or something.
Uh-huh.
But,
what kind of snake was it? Do you need to
I have no idea. It had to have been a long one. It was several feet long, so it had to be one of the boas or something, whatever. I forget if they had it. I think it was boas or anacondas. I'm sure anacondas are down south, so I think it was a boa.
Did you see a lot of snakes over there?
I didn't see a lot of them, but, yeah, they had them. You'd see them every once in a while, but no, I didn't personally never saw a lot of them, no.
Right.
There were several of them. I think they said there was 25 different varieties of snakes in Vietnam, and 23 of them were poisonous.
Mm.
So you never really question one way or the other if this thing was poisonous or not.
Mm-hmm.
You just took it for granted it was, and either got out of the way or ignored it, and hopefully it would go away.
Mm-hmm.
But you were always leery of it, especially when you're out in the bush or something like that, whether it be, I know sometimes they would get into your bunkers, and they get in between the sandbags, and you had no idea what it was. It was one of those little vipers or something like that, so you'd have to tear your bunker completely apart. I never had to do it, but I watched guys that had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd have to tear that thing down sandbag by sandbag, and it would take them forever to build a thing, and then they had to disassemble it because he couldn't sleep in there.
Mm-hmm.
You never knew if the thing was going to come out and get you or not.
How did you even know if the snake was in there to begin with?
Oh, somebody would have seen it.
Okay.
And so they had to tear it down, or they would have heard it, heard it hissing in there, something like that. And so, that's the way we, with the rats, we always, you could hear them running around up in there. They'd burrow through the things. You could just hear them up in there all the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you flew down to Da Nang, and this is where you left Vietnam?
Mm-hmm, that's where I left Vietnam.
Okay. Was it on a commercial flight? Or?
Yeah, it was another commercial flight, and the Marines either went to San Francisco or they went down to El Toro. Mm-hmm. We either went to Travis Air Force Base at San Francisco or they went to El Toro and down towards Los Angeles. Worked for Camp Pendleton.
Mm-hmm.
And usually if you were getting discharged, like I was going to get discharged, when I got back. So that's one of the reasons why they sent me to Treasure Island. Usually the guys that had time to do after they got back would go down south. They would fly south. So we left Anang and you flew to Okinawa, and I spent 4 or 5 days there, I believe. Yeah. And once again you had to stand inspections. And it was pretty, it wasn't bad. I got there on a Thursday, and Friday, you wanted to go out in the village. You wanted to get off base. Well, we weren't supposed to get off base, but went to the club, I think, Thursday night, and enlisted men's club, and there was a guy in there. We got talking to somebody at the bar, and there's a couple other guys, and he had gotten wounded at Khe Sanh.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a clerk. They made him a clerk in Okinawa. He was wounded bad enough they didn't send him back. I guess he had enough time in Vietnam, so they didn't send him back. So they made him a clerk for whatever company he was with. And this guy, we got talking to him, and he got to be good friends with him. And he says, come on, we'll go down here. We went back to the office that he worked in, and he typed us up some phony IDs. And we got weekend passes, because we didn't have to stand inspections on weekends or anything. You just stood around and basically drank. So on the weekends. So from Friday night, Friday afternoon to Monday morning, we had liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was great.
What'd you do?
Oh, well, we went to usual stuff.
Such as?
Yeah. Well, you'd go to the bars and you'd find some girls and stuff like that.
Okay. We'll leave it at that then.
Yeah, we'll leave it.
Okay.
All right. That's about, you had money because most guys had money because we didn't spend a lot in Vietnam. $5. Really, all you need is about $15 a pay period, so every 2 weeks, and then most time you had change left over.
Mm-hmm.
So you were able to save a lot of money. And once you get close to the end, you started keeping more money.
Mm-hmm.
Because you knew you were probably going to give some liberty time. And so we did. So, yeah, you spent the money.
Okay.
And then from there, I spent a whole 4 or 5 days at Okinawa. Had to get haircuts, and we stood inspections, and they kind of cleaned you up a little and got you acclimated, which really wasn't too bad. The Army didn't do it that way. The Army's, all those guys, one day they're in Vietnam, the next day, 24 hours later, they're walking the streets in the States.
Right.
And a lot of those guys had a really hard time. Whereas we spent, 4 to 5 days, you got your gear, and in a way, it was a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted to get out of there, but you got you back to, acting somewhat civil.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to get your gear, so you had a sea bag. You had to claim your sea bag that you checked in on the way over, and you got your clothes, your gear. And they had mine. I was reported missing. I had no idea why, but my gear, my sea bag had been put in a warehouse for the missing in action guys.
Hmm.
So it was, when I went to claim it, it wasn't there. And they said, oh, they checked your names, find your name. And they said, oh, you're over in this other warehouse. So we had to catch a cab and go over there and get it. But for some reason or another, I was considered missing in action.
Hmm.
And
do you know why?
No, I have no idea why. And my mother, God love her, somebody came up to her in the States at home, and they said they told her, and this about freaked her out, because they told her, they said, we heard that your son was missing in action,
mm-hmm.
and that she hadn't gotten no notice or anything. So for several days until she finally got that verified, and I don't know how she got it verified. It may have been letters from me. But she was quite upset for several days.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody came up to her in the post office, I believe, and said, "We're sorry. We heard that your son was missing in action."
Mm.
Ooh. So I don't know how it ever got out because it wasn't on the record or anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was the flight back like out of Vietnam and then away from Okinawa? How'd you feel?
Definitely relieved, especially when leaving Vietnam. You're always afraid, it's going to get shot out of the sky or something like that. But once you finally cleared, it was great. Of course, it was all men, basically. Different branches of service.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just great. Everybody let out a cheer and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then when I finally left Okinawa, and this is how chicken things were. We were all standing there on the at the airport getting ready to leave, and it was pretty much Marines, but it was, we were all getting ready to leave, and I'd never seen a B-52, actual seen one. I'd been on the receiving end of seeing them, you know, seeing the bombs fall and everything like that, but I'd never actually seen one because they flew so high up, you never saw one in the air. And so, sitting over there on the strip with some B-52s, and I started taking pictures of it. My MPs come running up there and grabbed my camera and took the film out and threw that. You know, they say, I'm thinking, you know, every Vietnamese, North Vietnamese and Viet Cong knows what a B-52 looks like. It's not like I'm going to sell these photos or something. But, yeah, they took my film and gave me my camera back, at least. But they took the film and stripped it out of there and kept it. And then we were sitting there, and here come a bunch of Army guys going on R&R. And they took that flight, the flight we were supposed to go on. We were supposed to go to Japan. We were flying from Okinawa to Japan and then from Japan to Travis Air Force Base. And we got bumped. This particular flight got bumped from the guys going home that already spent a year or more in Vietnam. We got bumped by some Army guys, and it was officers. Another reason why we didn't like officers. They bumped us because they were going on R&R. So we got bumped out of there for R&R, so we had to go back and spend another night at, I think it was Camp Hansen's the name of it, from the Marine base, Marine camp at Okinawa. So we had to spend another night at Camp Hansen because these guys, these officers were going on R&R, so just say we were mad about that. So, but then we finally got it. And that was like, I forget how long the flight was. We flew from Okinawa to Japan itself, got off, and of course they wouldn't let you wander around. You had this little restricted area in the airport, in the terminal, and you went to there and you sat there while they refueled. And I'm not sure if we changed planes or not, but I know we sat there for a little while and flew straight to San Francisco. And it was, once we got there, you know, the sun was up when we landed, and the pilots were really nice. They knew we'd all hadn't seen the States, and so they flew, they went up north to Napa, in the Napa country, in the valleys and stuff, and they took us, instead of flying in there, straight into Travis, they kind of went off course and flew down below, flew low, and flew over the scenic part of California, Northern California, and they were pointing things out to us, and we could see the vineyards, and it was really pretty. They treated you nice. It was a really nice gesture on their part, and I think these guys were probably, most of them were veterans, so most of the pilots were, and they were pretty sympathetic to us, so it was nice. And then we landed, it was, San Francisco was December, so it was cold. It was cold to us especially, because we just come out of Okinawa, which is pretty humid and hot. So we landed, and we all had on our summer clothes. We didn't have long sleeve shirts on. We had our summer uniforms, because that's what it was when we left. So everybody, it seemed like most guys, myself included, ended up catching a really bad cold before you ever got down the steps. And so everybody was feeling pretty rot within just in a few hours after you get off the plane. You were feeling pretty sick, but that didn't slow you down. But when I got off the plane, when looking across the way to the fence around an airstrip, there was all these protesters. Of course, this is San Francisco in 1968. I couldn't have picked a worse time or a worse place to land as far as anti-war feelings went. And all these protesters, you know, baby killer and all this stuff, they had their cards out and they were screaming at you and saying, "Well, this is great." So, welcome home.
Did the Marine Corps tell you anything about, you know, this is what you might expect?
No, nothing was said, you know, and of course we'd heard all this stuff. And when I left to go to Vietnam, of course I was pretty well isolated, insulated really from the outside, there wasn't that much anti-war stuff going on. Now, on the way, when I spent the time at Camp Pendleton, going through training there just to get ready to go over, mm-hmm. we had gone out and, you know, gone up to Disneyland and stuff like that. Nobody really gave you a hard time. They just kind of ignored you. But by the time we got back, over a year later, yeah, feelings definitely changed. And, so, you know, we had to go through customs. They inspected you, see if you had any, you know, some guys trying to smuggle in dope or, some type of weapon, so they'd go through your sea bag. Really, it was kind of disappointing. They told you they were going to do that. They didn't mm-hmm. really do it. They just opened your sea bag, looked in, that was it. You could have had a bomb in there mm-hmm. underneath the stuff, and nobody would have known it. But they checked you, and so I had to catch, I was going to Treasure Island, Navy base there mm-hmm. in the Gulf, or in the bay, mm-hmm. and, so I caught a civilian bus, and there wasn't that many, military going there. I think just only if you were going to get discharged, you went there. And so I got on the civilian bus, and it's like a just typical city bus. And I was one of the few, in fact, I may have been the only military guy on there. And the place, and it was pretty well crowded, and they swung in there and they picked you up and got on there, and I was sitting there and I was had my bag, and my sea bag was in the underneath. And so I was sitting there, and I was in uniform. I was on the aisle seat, mm-hmm. and I was about a little over halfway back. And so they was making stops on the way to Treasure Island. Mm-hmm. And this long-haired hippie sucker come by me as he was getting off, and I didn't pay attention to him. I was just, you know, you could feel no one was speaking to you. You could feel kind of hostility on the mm-hmm. bus because, you know, I'm military and they hated military. Most people, especially around that area, seem like. And this hippie, he goes by me. And as he goes by me, he just kind of looks over towards me and spits. Mm-hmm. Guy was nuts for doing that. So then he just kept walking like it wasn't no big deal. He spit on me.
Did he spit on you?
Yeah, he spit on me.
Okay.
And he landed right on my leg. And as soon as he did that, you know, you son of a... So I jump up, and he's walking by me, and I just reached up and grabbed his hair, mm-hmm. and I yanked him back, and then I started whipping on him. Mm-hmm. And I had him down the aisle, and I'm just wailing away on this guy. Mm-hmm. And some lady, I don't know why, but elderly lady, she either had a cane or an umbrella, but she jumps on my back, and she's whacking on me. Mm-hmm. So I'm wailing on this guy, and she's back there wailing on me, and people are starting to scream and holler, and mm-hmm. and the bus driver was a big black guy, and he had been a Korean War veteran, and either Army or Marines, and he was a big guy. So you could just, you know, I'm just beating on this guy, and I just lost it because, you know, it wasn't that long before I was fighting for my life, and this guy's nuts, crazy enough to do this. So I'm swinging on this guy, and this lady, she's swinging on me, and I'm trying to get her off me and try to hit this guy, too. Mm-hmm. And he slams on the brakes, and people are screaming. He comes just throwing people out of the way, come running down the aisle. And he got the lady off me, and then he grabbed me and pulled me off that guy. Mm-hmm. And I told him what the deal was. Mm-hmm. And so he was luckily, like I say, he'd been a vet, mm-hmm. veteran. So he stops the truck or the bus and gets the lady off, and then he just literally picked up the hippie and just literally dragged him down the aisle and physically threw him off the bus, and he was just laying there in a heap. And, of course, the people, they were more for the hippie, I believe, than they were for me, but they didn't say anything because they, mm-hmm. they knew I was pretty well nuts by that time. And so my uniform just looked like crap, and Marine Corps, Marine Corps always prides itself on appearance.
Yes.
So I thought, oh, God, I won't catch it when I get to Treasure Island. Mm-hmm. It'll look like hell. And so the bus driver, when we got to Treasure Island, I thought, well, when I report in, I'm going to end up in a brig probably on this one. And he goes in with me, and he was, he explained to him what the deal was. He said, you know, don't blame this guy. You know, it wasn't his fault. Mm-hmm. And he said, he told him I was jumped on the bus. And so So I got out of that. I didn't get out of it, but I didn't get in trouble.
You didn't get any kind of trouble?
No, I didn't get any trouble, thanks to God, to the bus driver. Hmm. And so then after that, it was spent 5 days there, and it was just goofy as all get out. It was a strange place. It was a barracks. It was a Marine barracks on a Navy base, and it was like a two-story old wooden two-story barracks from World War II. Mm-hmm. And there was guys either getting discharged like I was, or they had been court-martialed and were waiting for discharge. Mm-hmm. And you talk about a strange mix. Mm-hmm. There would be guys that had been, I think the sergeant that was in charge of us, he tried to get really, you know, he tried to get... Start trying to order us around and everything like that. He wanted us to scrub the barracks with a brush, you know, the floor with a scrub brush and all this stuff. And we pretty well told him to stick it because we weren't going to do any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, we just gotten back from Vietnam, and the last thing we were going to do was going to do that stuff. So he kind of calmed down on that and didn't try to do us anything. But he was he would go in his room, and we'd have inspections, or we'd have, well, basically, yeah, he had a formation in the morning, and it was like 6 o'clock. Oh, I can know, probably wasn't that early, probably like 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. He'd have an inspection. Then you had to do stuff until like noon. You had another inspection, and then you had liberty mm-hmm. from noon till 6 or 7 the next day, morning. So you had a lot of time. So most everybody just took off and went to San Francisco because all you had to do is catch the bus. But this guy was, he would go in his room after the 12 o'clock inspection, and he would lock the door and turn up the radio so he couldn't hear you, and he wouldn't come out till the next time, till the next day. Hmm. And he was just, you know, if you had problems or anything, you needed the information. You didn't get it from this guy. Hmm. But, yeah, we had guys in charge of us that had no insignias on their, clothing as to what rank they were or anything like that. And of course, at first, you did what they told you. But then after a while, you started looking at these guys, and pretty soon, you know, you're not doing anything. These guys tell you, you have no idea what they are. Mm-hmm. If they're privates or you know, first sergeants, you had no idea what they were.
Right.
But it was these guys that had been busted and got court-martialed, and they were already served their time in the brig, and they stuck them in there with us to wait for their dishonorable or undesirable discharge. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was kind of strange, you know, with these guys. And so pretty soon we weren't, you know, we were pretty much on our own. But mm-hmm. during that 4 or 5 hours, they would, that you had to be there, they gave you, they checked your teeth and your, all that stuff, give you medicals and make sure you were fit to get discharged. Mm-hmm. But that's about it. Jesus, didn't do much.
So when did you actually get to go home? When were you discharged?
I got discharged the 10th of December, 1968, and they took you to the San Francisco airport. You got your plane, and military flew, you got a discount. So you went to the airport, and you made connections. And I flew from there, flew to Indianapolis. And then, flew to Chicago, and had some layover time. But that time, it was pretty dark. Plus, you were gaining R's because we was going from the West Coast to the East Coast. So I gained some R's, and so I had 2 or 3 hours to spend at Chicago. And I went into the bar there, and some older vets were sitting in there, and so they actually bought me some beer, so that was great.
Did you have your uniform on?
The only way you could get a military discount was to have your uniform on.
Okay.
And they, once you finally got out of San Francisco, they didn't say much to you. You know, it wasn't too bad. You know, a lot of people didn't like you, but, you know, it wasn't like it is now where, you know, you look at a guy in uniform and you got a lot of respect for him. Back then, the whole atmosphere was different.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of anti-military feelings. Mm-hmm. So you never really felt comfortable. And I knew a lot of guys, if they were off base, they never put the uniform on. They just, they wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you stuck out like a sore thumb, especially Marine Corps, because we always had to have them high and tight, mm-hmm. haircuts and stuff
right.
like that. But even then, the guys would not wear their uniforms. It was, you were almost embarrassed. Some guys were. Mm-hmm. And I never, you know, once I got home, anyway, I got home. It wasn't bad. I landed in Louisville, Kentucky. Called my, by that time, my mother and sister and brother-in-law, they knew I was coming, so they were waiting. So I got home pretty early in the morning, like 7 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I called them, and they came over.
How was that reunion?
Oh, it was very, it was really nice. But my mother, God love her, she had no sense of direction. My sister wasn't any better.
Mm-hmm.
So they missed the airport, and they've only probably been there 100 times before.
Right.
But it was probably a 15-minute drive from where they live, maybe 20 minutes. And they missed it and went on down to the next county down before mm-hmm. they figured it out. My brother-in-law had gotten there. He'd gone ahead and driven over. And so we sat there, and it was really nice. And we sat there and waited and waited and waited, and finally they showed up. Well, it should have taken a half hour, 45 minutes, ended up taking a couple hours
mm-hmm.
for them because they got lost, actually.
Right.
And But then we came home, and so.
What was it like transitioning to civilian life?
Oh, it wasn't that hard. You got unemployment, mm-hmm. so you didn't have to go looking for a job, and I have a pretty close-knit family, so, and I got a lot of cousins and aunts and uncles around here, so naturally the first thing you do is start going to visit. Most of the guys that I was with, I grew up with, a lot of them were still in the service, so there wasn't that many guys around to hang out with, but I did, and I found some guys were getting discharged too about the same time I was, so
mm-hmm.
you just started finding the guys that you hung out with, and especially the guys that were in the service. Now, there were a few that weren't,
mm-hmm.
and those and to this day, you have some leery feelings about a guy that wasn't in the service. You know, it's about your age,
mm-hmm.
and if he wasn't in the service, you want to know why he wasn't in the service.
Right.
You know, is it a medical? Now, if it's a medical reason, I can understand that, but if, outside of that, and it took me a long time before I would ever even consider being a friend with somebody who wasn't a veteran.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're talking 20 years probably.
Wow.
Several years before I would. Now, if I had to work, being a teacher, I was around a lot of people like that.
Mm-hmm.
I never would consider someone a friend if they, a man around my age, if they hadn't been a veteran. Because it just, to me, they were the lowest of the low.
You've changed since then?
I've mellowed a little. But for the most part, I still feel, you know, if you're my age, if you're in your middle 50s,
mm-hmm.
give or take, and you haven't, and you're a man, and you look like I want to know why you weren't in the service.
Right.
I don't go up and ask them, but I'm leery of people like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
To me, they were dodging the draft, and that was to me, that was an ultimate sin to not serve your country back
right.
then, especially.
Right. Go ahead. Well, how much did you talk about your Vietnam experiences? Did people ask you about them?
They would ask, but I pretty much shut up. If it was another veteran, I might, you know, you kind of feel them out, too. You know, kind of feel each other out, see what you did and where you were.
Mm-hmm.
And, but no, I wouldn't, for the most part, I would never talk about it to anyone, even my wife. And I'd known her since I was, you know, seventh grade, so I was 12 years old. We just went to different elementary schools, and we went to the same junior high and high school, and so that's where we met. Now, we never dated or anything, but I knew her. It was a small school, so you knew everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started, she had written me the whole time I was over there.
Mm-hmm.
I'd ask her out on my way over, and she had, for some reason or other, she turned me down. So
mm-hmm.
I guess her conscience started bothering her after I left, and she started writing me. And so we kept up the correspondence the whole time I was over there.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got back, she was awfully pretty and awfully nice, so I guess she did nice enough to write me.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and visited her, and her dad met me at the door, and I was still in uniform then.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he's an old World War II guy, and he thought I was great because I was in the Marine Corps.
Right.
So I was welcomed by him, and then, of course, I'd known her for a long time, and so then we started dating, and the rest is history. 9 months later, we married, and so she had no problems with that. And I really never experienced, not trying to get a job. my father had been a machinist, and I always thought that's what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to most of the machine shops in Louisville, Kentucky, because it's only about 10 miles away. And no, they didn't. It was still a lot of, that's the one time I experienced anti-military feelings. And, of course, I may have just felt that way. But once you've put down that you were military, you know, if you on the back then you put down there was one of the questions military service, and when you put that down, a lot of times that was pretty much the end of things. You know, you never heard from them again or something like that. And somebody else would get a job and you didn't, and they hadn't been in the service. So it, you know, started adding up, and me, I was just paranoid. But yeah, there was I couldn't find a job in that area. And so I, there was a powder plant, we called it powder plant, Indiana Army Ammunition Plant, 7 miles from here. And that's where they, made the gunpowder and for the, mostly for the artillery. In fact, when I was in Vietnam, some of the canisters that, from the artillery guys, we'd steal it, or we wouldn't steal them, but we'd get them. And, we'd use them, fill them up with dirt, we'd use them for, you know, like sandbags and stuff like that. We'd we'd use them, and they would have the Indiana Army Ammunition Plant on there in Charlestown, Indiana. And I say, hey, and my mother was working there at the time, so it was always kind of nice. But then, once again, the anti-war feelings about that. Sometimes you crack those, they'd break open those things to get the powder charges out. There'd be nuts and bolts and stuff in there instead of charges. So there was some little bit of sabotage there, too, you know, anti-war feelings at, in that area. But so I got a job there. And at the time, they were employing like 19,000 people.
Wow.
Because the war was going so strong.
Right.
And the physical was basically you jumped. They took your pulse before when you got there, and they you jumped up and down like 10 times, and they took your pulse afterwards, and you're still breathing, and your heart was still pumping, you got the job. And that was pretty much it. And so, you know, I started working there, and I worked there for about nine months. And it was good. It was good pay, great pay. But you knew the job was going to be temporary, because whenever the war was over, you knew most people were going to lose their job.
How much did you keep up with the continuing war effort?
Constantly. You just, you couldn't, you know, if there was something, article in the paper or a magazine or on TV, I kept up with it. I always kept up with it. My brother-in-law, he ended up being my brother-in-law, he and I joined together, and he'd already gotten out, discharged, so we both, and you know, we saw each other quite often, because at the time we were dating sisters, and, we both kept up on it quite a bit.
What did you think of the continuing war effort? What was your opinion of how the United States was prosecuting the war?
I didn't really think too highly of it, but when they invaded Cambodia, I thought, finally. You know, finally they're going after them. Because, you know, there was that line right there where they would hit you, and then they would go in, and then they could run across this imaginary line right there, and you couldn't pursue them. And that just, you know, like us, especially us up north, Laos was our problem.
Right.
You know, the guys down south was Cambodia. And so we thought, finally, they're expanding this thing, they're going to do it right. But, yeah, I was real happy about that. And you always think, oh, I wish I was there. You know, when a big operation would come up or something like that, you just think, God, I wish I was there. Wish I was there. You really kind of missed it, and you worried about some of the guys that you were with. And, of course, everybody always says, well, I'll write. And some guys did. But pretty soon you just don't do that. You know, I write back and sometimes. But I always kept up with it. Because guys rotated out. And pretty soon most of the guys that you were friends with, they'd been gone anyway. And I always kept up with it. Even when I went to college. So I knew my life wasn't going to be too great around here, so I went ahead and got married and went to Vincennes University. Because Indiana had a ruling, if you had an honorable discharge, that they had to accept you in any state-supported college. It didn't, as long as you had graduated from high school or you had a GED and you had an honorable discharge, you were in.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew they had to take me. So there wasn't any problem like that. The trouble was, I wasn't really the greatest material. I goofed off in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't take a lot of the academic classes because I knew I was going into the military and I didn't need it. So I took the SATs and all that because I was just, you just took it because you're supposed to. That's it. And it didn't really matter what your school, you could have put a score of one on there and they had to take you.
Mm-hmm.
Being a vet. And so I did that and then I went to Vincennes and there wasn't, Vincennes is it was a junior college and it's very small and there weren't that much anti-war mm-hmm. stuff there. So I was married too, so I didn't have to live on campus.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't bad.
Tell me about the anti-war movement. How did it affect you once you got home?
I never saw it too much in Louisville. It wasn't a big issue. You know, you'd have people at the courthouse, at the federal building. But as far as, like, on some of the campuses, there's the University of Louisville. You probably heard of them, basketball. But I really wasn't aware of it that much. You see it on TV and you see it in the newspapers, but around here, no, it wasn't that. You know, practically everybody was in the service. You know, most of the guys, like I said, there was over 50 of us in the service from my little, just in my class and close to the other graduating classes before and after. There were so many guys in the service that you just never worried about it,
mm-hmm.
thought that much about it. Now, when I got to Vincennes, nah, it wasn't that bad. Most of the teachers there were older,
mm-hmm.
and so a lot of them were World War II or Korean War vets or just peacetime veterans, and so that wasn't bad. Now, a year later, I went up to Indiana State in Terre Haute,
mm-hmm.
and there was several anti-war things up there, and it got to be, in my particular area, most of the men, and it was basically a guy area, industrial arts. You know, most of your shop teachers are men,
mm-hmm.
So there weren't very few girls in my particular curriculum in my area.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of the guys, I'd say at least half the guys, were vets. So you got to be, you know, pretty, it was kind of nice.
Right.
Now, on the others, if you were in business or some other major, then, you had a lot of anti-war. And it would, it got to the point where if you were a veteran, you could always tell the veterans. They just stuck out like a sore thumb. They were older than most of the other guys. You know, I was 22 when I started college, and most of your normal school guys are 18, 19 years old when they start. And so you stuck out because she was still, you know, I kept my hair relatively short, especially for back then.
Mm-hmm.
And, you got long hair and was pretty much in. Afros were pretty much in.
Right.
And you stuck out. And, you know, I wore an old field jacket.
Mm-hmm.
And it got to the point where most of the hippies, and I call them hippies, but, you know, those type of kids, they were wearing field jackets. So I didn't wear that anymore because I didn't want to be identified with them.
Right.
And it really got to the point where you were ashamed almost to admit that you were a veteran. And I still get mad at myself for those feelings.
Mm-hmm.
But you just didn't admit it. But and I've had it, you know, I'd be sitting in a class, an English class or something like that, and people next to you would find out you were a veteran, they'd get up and move.
Really?
You know, yeah, they didn't want to even be associated. They'd have to sit near you. Yeah, you were like you had, you know, almost like you had leprosy. And so you got to be pretty mad. But luckily I was married, so I could just leave when classes were over and go home.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the guys, they had to live on campus, and I felt more sorry for them than I did my problem.
Right.
But, you got to the point where you never walked across campus by yourself because two or three of them would come up and start giving you a hard time. Pretty soon you got in a fight.
Mm-hmm.
And so you always got to the point where at least you had two of you would be walking across campus together, at least mm-hmm. two. And if you were two or more, they didn't have nerve to bother you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you were by yourself, yeah, they'd try something. And then one-on-one, they wouldn't try anything. But if it was two or three or four or more, they'd jump you sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And you go into the union, and it was always kind of, it got to a point where we started getting a kick out of it. We go into the union, and, we had our own little section, and nobody would bother you because if you were in numbers, they just didn't have the nerve to do anything. And some guys are disabled, you know, they have arm missing, or maybe on crutches, or basically a cane, they'd have leg missing, something like that. One guy, you know, a couple guys had glass eyes because they'd had eyes injuries. And then we always got a kick out of it because we'd sit there and it would get deathly quiet. And pretty soon, you know, people start getting up and moving to the other side of the student union. So after a while, you kind of got a kick out of it. You kind of go in and just see how long it would take before somebody would just get up and move. But yeah, it was interesting.
Wow. How did that affect you psychologically?
Oh, I was really pissed. I was just mad. I was mad for several years. And then, of course, in my area, being a teacher, most of the men teachers my age only became teachers to get out of the military, because that was one of the exemptions was teachers, ministers, and if you had a job that was vital to the defense, military defense, if you're like a machinist or if you were even a farmer, and you could get out of the service. And so to us it was just, you know, it was just scumbags as far as I'm concerned. So I get out into the workforce, and I might be 20 guys in the building, and I'd be the only veteran. Except for maybe, at the time, there's still several World War II guys. So there was several World War II or Korean War veterans. But most of the guys my age, I'd be the only one. And, I never really, until this day, I still don't hang around with too many men teachers my age that aren't in service. I just never did it. I just had no respect for them.
How long did this kind of anti-military feeling that you experienced and the actions that you experienced, how long did that last? When did that start really fading away?
Oh, probably in the 70s. Probably not until Ronald Reagan finally became president, and the pride of military came back. But during Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford and Nixon, no, there's still a lot of anti-military feelings. And of course, once they did away with the draft, then in the 70s, I think it was 69, I believe, somewhere around 69 or 70, they did away with the draft, blanket draft, and then went to the lottery.
Right.
And that was, things weren't as bad. Of course, Vietnam was still going on, so as long as Vietnam was going on, there was all kinds of anti-war stuff. But then when they finally did away with the draft, I think most of the anti-military feelings went.
Okay.
So,
how did you feel about the United States withdrawal in 1973?
I was mad, actually.
Really?
You know, we fought, died, and got wounded and all that stuff, and then we left. I understand why they did it. I just don't think it was the right choice. I don't think we ever fought the war right anyway.
Tell me about that. What could have we done differently?
Well, for one thing, the borders was crazy. You had these, a lot of times, just depends on where you were, you had to get permission to shoot. You know, if you could see the enemy out there, you couldn't just do it. A lot of times you had to call in and get permission. Well, that would take a little while sometimes. Just the overall thing was just stupid. That's another reason why I liked being out in the field. A lot of times you just didn't have that problem.
Right.
You know, you just did it and get it over with. And in the rear, if you were on guard duty and you saw some what you thought was enemy action out there, movement, you'd have to call in and get permission. And, you know, it's just stupid stuff. It's like they didn't trust your judgment because you were just a stupid enlisted guy. And it just, the overall thing was just ridiculous.
Did you think that the South Vietnamese could take over the war when we left efficiently and effectively?
I thought it was one of those things you did and you didn't, because I had been around some really good South Vietnamese soldiers, but then you knew overall that they were, most of them were just so incompetent. And as far as the soldiers themselves, it wasn't their fault. Like I said earlier, it was the officers. Their leadership was just terrible, very corrupt. very inept. They didn't have to. You know, a lot of times, they seemed like whoever had the best connections or the most money, they're the ones that became the officers. You know, it didn't matter their experience and if their training. But now there was a lot of good officers too that had fought the French or fought the Viet Minh when they when the French were there. They had fought for the French, and so there were some pretty good ones. But no, it didn't surprise me, but of course I kept up with it, and you know, and then they had that big Easter offensive, and they come roaring across the border, and yeah, it just, it really upset me and my brother-in-law. By that time we were both married to the sisters, and when I would come home, we would talk about it, and then when they finally, when the fall of Saigon, that really made me mad.
How did you feel in April 75? When you saw that happening?
Just complete disappointment. Just a lot of disappointment, because everything that you'd done was for nothing. You thought, but I changed my mind, because I know that we were trying to do the right thing, and we just didn't do it the right way. I have no regrets as far as ever doing what I did, and none whatsoever. I'd do it again in a heartbeat if I was younger. I've never really had a feelings that you should, you know, you don't pick your wars. To me, it's like being a policeman. You're a policeman, I was in the military, but you're a policeman, you get assigned to guard some person that's just evil, or, you know, you have no use whatsoever for them, you think they're just terrible, but your job is to guard that person with your life, if you have to. And so you don't question it, you do it. You may not like it, your own personal feelings are beside the point. And so I've never thought, to me, you don't pick your wars. Well, I like this one, so I'll serve. I don't like this one, so I won't serve.
Right.
You serve, and whatever comes up, you do. And that's the way I've always felt. And so whether you like the war or not, it's beside the point. It's just not a relevant thing. You do what you're supposed to do. And so that's the way I've always felt about that. I hadn't really at the time. I thought that we were doing the right thing because they told us we were doing the right thing. You know, you believed at the time, you didn't question your government. I didn't anyway. That's the way I was raised. You know, if they told you to do it, you did it.
Right.
And you knew that they wouldn't tell you something that was wrong. Of course, you found out later either did. But you know, it's like your mom tells you something and you do it, and you find out later she's lying to you. You know, you're disappointed, but you still do it.
What kind of lessons do you think the United States learned after this experience?
I don't know. I don't know that they learned anything. Especially because at the time they downsized the military so bad. The morale was so bad because of Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, God love him, he's probably the best, one of the nicest people in the world, but he was just so incompetent as a president. And of course, I hate to even admit that I voted for Jimmy Carter, but I did. It's the last time I ever voted Democrat in my life. But you know, the first thing he does is give a blanket amnesty to all the guys in Canada and Sweden and everything. Very first day, I couldn't believe it. I thought, you son of a... And as, in fact, I even had a chance to shake his hand. Years later, I was on the same flight, flying to D.C. In fact, I was going to a Quezon reunion, and it was the first time I'd... Fred Switz, and it's one of the first reunions. I'd been to one other one on my own, and... I didn't know anybody. My outfit's so small, the Antos, there just wasn't anybody there. And so these other guys, they knew each other, and they were civil to me. They didn't, but you know, there wasn't any camaraderie there. And so I just turned around and left. And I wasn't going to go to the big one in D.C. I think that was the 25th anniversary, and I wasn't going to go. But Fred Switz, who I had met, who I was in the caisson with, who lived up in Chicago, he calls me and says he's going, he wants me to go. Yeah, I said, nah. And he calls and tells me again that another guy, there's going to be another guy there from Montos, Gary Dahlheimer, and he's flying in from Fresno, California. And so at the last minute, I changed my mind. I go. So I didn't have enough time to drive, so I was going to fly. So the flight left Louisville, went to Atlanta, and then to D.C. Mm-hmm. Well, Atlanta, I had this layover, and I noticed all these guys. They just looked like a Men in Black deal. Mm-hmm. These guys stand around real serious, and mm-hmm. I never paid attention to them. But they were the CIA or Secret Service, and they were for President Carter. Well, of course, he goes on first. No, he goes on first because he's sitting in first class, naturally. And so all these guys, they go on, so then we go on. And somebody says, on the plane, I'm sitting back and coach, and he says, President Carter's on the plane. Okay. Oh, crap. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't real thrilled with that. Didn't matter one way or the other to me. So then the poor guy, God love him, he comes back, and he was nice enough to do this. Mm-hmm. He's come back, and he's going to shake hands with all the passengers. Mm-hmm. And he gets to me, and he puts out his hand, and I just looked at him and shook my head no. And I couldn't shake his hand. I know he's one of the nicest. He'd probably love to have him for a neighbor. Mm-hmm. He's probably the type of guy he'd love to have for a neighbor. But I just couldn't shake his hand for what he'd done to the for the draft Dodgers. Mm-hmm. And so then when I got off the plane, that Fred and Gary was standing there at the airport waiting for me. And of course, by this time, you know, President Carter already left. Mm-hmm. And I was telling him, I said, yeah, he come around, he's shaking hands, and they all looked at me and said, you didn't shake his hand, did you?
How did he do it?
I said, no, I couldn't do it.
How did President Carter react?
Oh, he said, okay. You know, it wasn't an issue with him. Mm-hmm. And he just, you know, nodded his head and smiled and said, okay, he just went on. Mm-hmm. Then, but I just couldn't do it. And I told my wife later, and she was so mad at me. You didn't shake his hand. I said, no. I said, it doesn't surprise me, but...
Right.
You know, you should have shook his hand. I said, no, I just couldn't do it.
Right. You know? What did you think of the way the media covered the Vietnam War?
Well, I thought it was terrible.
Why?
I think the media was one of the biggest reasons why we lost the war.
Really?
Oh, yes, I sure do.
Okay.
There was so much anti-war feelings amongst the media,
mm-hmm.
and Peter Jennings and Dan Rather and Walter Cronkite and all those. You know, the Tet Offensive was... was really a victory for us.
Mm-hmm.
The Tet Offensive, we just mangled them. We just slaughtered those guys. But if you listen to the news and read the papers, no, we got our butt kicked.
Mm-hmm.
And it really helped. It boosted the morale of the enemy, of the NVA and the Viet Cong,
mm-hmm.
because they were, you know, they get all the magazines and they were picking up on all the news. And they were against us. It's that simple. As far as I'm concerned, the media. Oh, I still don't have a great deal of use for them, I really loathe the media. And I watched all the time and read all the time. Mm-hmm. And you would thought we was getting slaughtered, or we were either that or going into a village and just massacring innocent people.
Mm-hmm.
They magnified the bad things, and then very seldom would ever write about the good things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could go, and you would have thought that Saigon was just overrun. You know, it was a massacre, that the Americans were just getting their butt kicked.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. And, you know, you thought the same thing up around us, that we was getting our butt kicked up,
mm-hmm.
up north, and that the Tet Offensive was just, you know, the greatest thing going for the Viet Cong and the NVA, which, in fact, in reality, they were getting slaughtered.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think the media played a great part in that war, you know, as far as us not winning it.
Shaping public opinion to the negative.
Oh, you bet. Shaped public opinion like you wouldn't believe.
You think the presidents were affected by the media's coverage?
The president?
The presidents, yes.
Yeah,
surely.
Yeah. Poor Johnson. Not poor old Johnson. I shouldn't say that. I really don't have much use for the man.
Mm-hmm.
But Johnson, that's one of the reasons why, you know, he got out because of the anti-war protesting and everything like that, and
mm-hmm.
and that's another thing. They showed that all the time, and the NVA, they weren't stupid. They picked up on that like you wouldn't believe, and they thought that was great, and it just boosted them around and gave them more of a will
mm-hmm.
to go on. Yeah, I have no use for the media whatsoever as far as the Vietnam War goes, but the presidents, yeah, they had to be affected by that because their public opinion pretty well sways what they do.
Right.
Especially back then.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think It affected the presidents a lot. Ford, that's one of the reasons why I think main reason Gerald Ford wasn't elected, because he pardoned Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still associated with Vietnam. And that's the only reason why I voted for Jimmy Carter, because Gerald Ford had voted or had given amnesty to Richard Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
God, was that a...
Okay, we just came back from break. Let's talk about your personal experience in Vietnam. First of all, do you suffer any disabilities from your service?
Yes, I've got a disability, hearing disability, 50% hearing. But I knew there was a problem, but, you know, I never really thought that much about it until I, now my wife at the time when we were dating, she, you know, I knew that I couldn't hear that great, but I didn't think it was that bad.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked, they should have caught it when I was getting discharged at Treasure Island, but you went out so bad.
Mm-hmm.
They asked if there's any problems. I said, nah, no problems.
Okay.
So, yeah, they should have, they could have easily caught it down, but then I went to college and, it was right after I got to college. I knew I was sitting in class. I couldn't understand half the time what the teachers were telling me.
Mm-hmm.
And you have 1 year of discharge, from date of discharge, to file a claim.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had about 9 or 10 months on my... I've been out about 10 or 11 months, and I filed a claim. And,
okay.
So I wear hearing aids in both ears.
Okay. Any PTSD incidents?
Yeah, I guess. I was very skeptical of that for a long time. It wasn't until I got going to the case on reunions and stuff that I finally became a believer in that PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a farce. I thought it was a way for guys to get out of work,
mm-hmm.
to get free money. But yeah, I'm a firm believer in it now.
Okay.
How did
it change when you attended the veteran reunions?
Well, I've always been one of these type of people. You know, never showed your weakness.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a problem, you kept it to yourself. It's just the way I was raised,
mm-hmm.
and you dealt with it on your own terms, and you never sought help for anything. You know, physically, yeah, you go to the doctor, but if you had a problem, you took care of it yourself. A mental or emotional problem, you took care of it yourself. You
mm-hmm.
kept it within.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to, you know, being around these people, these guys, and there's a lot of guys out there that are flat out legitimate. They've got problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no, you know, two people can see the same thing and see it completely different. If you talk to another case on veteran, you get down there, you're going to hear all kinds of different stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to say, oh, this guy's lying. Well, he's not lying. He just saw it different than I did.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't question those kind of things. But yeah, I did question a lot of things. Of course, the media was always great. They showed all the, there's always long-haired hippie bums. I was always a Vietnam veteran, you know, slobbering, drooling on the wall and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they never showed normal people, guys who was working 9 to 5 and doing their job and going on raising families. They always showed the bums.
Right.
And so everybody perceived the Vietnam veterans as being wacko. Of course, everybody that committed a crime and butchered people, they always, first thing they would say, if the guy was a Vietnam veteran, they would always say Vietnam veteran, a former
mm-hmm.
Vietnam veteran. So just... everything was negative towards you, and so and you got to the point where people were using that as an excuse,
mm-hmm.
and that's the way I felt. Now, I still feel that way for some part, somewhat, because
mm-hmm.
I still think a lot of guys use it as an excuse, but there's a lot of guys out there that just have a hard time, have a
mm-hmm.
hard time dealing with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've got a lot more respect for people like that now.
Right. How do you feel about your own service in Vietnam today, looking back at it?
My own what?
Your own service in Vietnam.
Oh, I have no problems with it. You know, some things you wish you'd done different. Actually, it depends on what the incident was. But
so there's some things that you would change if you had a chance to?
I can't really say that there was. I was pleased with the way I acted and reacted for the most part. I'm sure somewhere in there are some things I thought I had been able to do it differently. I would.
Mm-hmm.
nothing major. I've always felt that I did well. I was pleased because that's what I wanted to find out, how I would react.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't complain about, I hate to be, hate to brag or anything, but I can't complain about, how I act. I'm sure there's some things I should have done different, but for the most part, no, I can't complain.
Okay. What do you think was the most significant thing that you learned while you were there in Vietnam?
Oh, Lord, if anything, you value life a lot more. You don't take things for granted.
Mm-hmm.
That's for sure. And no matter what comes up as a civilian, since I've been a civilian, I just look back at it and think, well, no matter what, it can't be any worse than what I've already gone through.
Mm-hmm.
So it does calm you in a way. You know, I don't have the rage like that. I can usually handle most situations because I just look back on my Marine Corps and my Vietnam experience thing. Well, nothing that's going to come up is going to
mm-hmm.
be worse than what I've gone through.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not too much I don't think I can handle.
Right.
You know, that way.
How do you think the war has most affected your life overall?
Well, a lot of people think I don't want to say consumed with it,
mm-hmm.
because I don't talk about it, especially around other people that don't know anything. I call them civilians. Non-military people, I very seldom would ever talk about it. But most people, it's kind of funny in a way because you're perceived as sort of a wacko.
Mm-hmm.
So most people don't give you a hard time. They just look at you, they just think of you differently.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it's kind of fun in a way because... most people, for the most part, once they know you, and especially if they know you're in the Marine Corps and been in Vietnam, they just don't give you a hard time.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, it's kind of fun. And like my students, once they know I'm a veteran, you know, they may give some other teacher twice as big as me a hard
mm-hmm.
time. But once they know that I've been in the Marine Corps, and especially once they know I've been a Vietnam veteran, they just don't give me a hard time.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know if I tell them something, I'm going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can pretty well intimidate the hell out of most of them.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's always some good intimidating no matter
what. Right.
But, it's got its pluses, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And for this time now, I finally changed schools. I was at a school in Jeffersonville, Indiana,
mm-hmm.
for over 20 years, and I finally changed to a more rural school. I got transferred voluntarily.
Mm-hmm.
And the feelings there is just so much different than it was at the larger one, as far as military goes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being a veteran, the kids are more interested, so it's kind of fun to talk to them sometimes.
Mm-hmm. What do you think are the biggest myths or misperceptions about the American soldier in Vietnam? You touched on some of them, but what do you think when folks hear Vietnam veteran, what do they think?
I think for the most part, anymore it's getting to the point where most of it's there's good feelings toward them, especially since... we've had some good presidents, not so much Bill Clinton,
mm-hmm.
but with George W. and Ronald Reagan,
mm-hmm.
The military came back strong, and the feelings towards Vietnam veterans has gotten a lot better. During Carter and Clinton, no. Especially, I detest Bill Clinton. He destroyed the military, and he made the Vietnamese or Vietnam veterans look bad.
Mm-hmm. How so?
Well, because he wasn't, and he, I hate to dwell on draft dodging, but he was a flat out draft dodger.
Mm-hmm.
And people in the press praised Clinton and everything, and it made him look good, which made the draft dodgers look good, and he pulled no bones about what he did, and people thought he was great.
Mm-hmm.
And I would venture to say that, especially around my little area here, I don't know of hardly any veteran that had any use whatsoever for Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it surprised me when I talked to guys from the more liberal states like Minnesota and up in that area,
mm-hmm.
where it doesn't matter, they vote straight Democrat, wouldn't matter who was on the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And they think Clinton's pretty and did a good job. And I'm so biased, and I'll admit it, I'm so biased, it wouldn't matter if the guy was the greatest president in the world. I wouldn't have any use for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll admit that. I am very biased towards that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I have no use whatsoever for people like him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 'Cause I think he gained everything he's got from not being in the service.
Mm-hmm. You said you teach. What subjects do you teach?
I teach industrial arts.
Okay.
They call it technology education, but I call it shop.
Right.
We do a lot more things than that anymore, but yeah.
So you said you talk to your students sometimes about your experiences
mm-hmm.
in Vietnam. What do you tell them about the Vietnam War?
Well, this little school I'm at Charlestown Middle School now, and I'm the only veteran in the whole building.
Okay.
And there's probably, 20, 30 teachers there at the most, maybe not even that many, maybe 25. And I'm the only male, well, I'm the only veteran, male or female. And it's kind of neat. They show a lot of respect for the veteran. In fact, one of the teachers, her husband was in the Navy,
mm-hmm.
and she had the kids write questions and everything. It was like for 2 days. All I did, and I didn't have my classes, in my classes, it was strictly Vietnam
mm-hmm.
Veterans Day. And they asked questions, and I told them, and I never had any problems. And I taught at other places for over 25 years and never had that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was really nice. The kids seemed to, for the most part, some of them actually didn't, but for the most part, the kids enjoyed it. We were very interested in it because they just don't know.
Yeah, their perceptions are shaped by a lot of the movies they see. And
movies?
They hear. What do you think about the movies that have come out on Vietnam?
Now, They Were Soldiers Once was an excellent movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one with Mel Gibson. That's probably the latest one.
Mm-hmm.
That was an excellent movie. It was followed the book very well.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't follow the whole book, but it was very well done. That was probably about as true, and I tell the kids, I said, and anybody, I said, if you want to see what Vietnam, probably the best movie on Vietnam is probably that one.
Why was it good to you?
It didn't pull any punches. It was just straightforward. It wasn't political at all. It was just the way it was. When the battles were going, that's the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
It showed the horror of it, but it didn't dwell on it. You know,
mm-hmm.
it didn't show the blood and guts and the guts hanging out and stuff like that. It was something that you could watch, and you knew what was happening, and it was very well acted. It was
mm-hmm.
very well done. As far as Marine boot camp goes, Full Metal Jacket's probably the best thing going on that. That was a riot.
Mm-hmm.
I just loved that one.
Mm-hmm.
The part after the boot camp, after they got to Vietnam, a little goofy, but
mm-hmm.
The boot camp was outstanding. And platoon, too much drug use.
Mm-hmm.
I think they dwelled on the drug use more than anything.
Okay.
4th of July, it was okay, but then I don't have much use for Ron Kovac, and I know people that know him now,
mm-hmm.
and they say he's pretty much of a whiner. And that's the way I got. Of course, I can understand you being bitter, being paralyzed on the waist down. I can understand you being very bitter.
Mm-hmm.
But I know people that know him now, and they don't like him.
Okay.
And even when I read the book and saw the movie, that's the way I thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
But
tell me what you think about Vietnam today.
I'd love to go back. In a way, I'm kind of glad that it's never gotten any better than it was. I think it's kind of, I guess, to me, it's still a third world, whereas any other country that we'd gone to war with has turned out to be much better off than they were before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of funny, and I guess a little sadistic way, that they're not any better off now than they were when we were before we got there.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's still, and it's their own fault. It's their own fault. They could probably develop that country into a great place like South Korea did.
Mm-hmm.
And any other country we've gone to war with has really come out ahead in the long run, whereas Vietnam hasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, I kind of get a kick out of it, my own little personal thing. But I have nothing against the country itself or the people.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. I don't have anything against the North Vietnamese that we fought against.
Mm-hmm.
I have no problems with them. I think the country's beautiful. They could really develop that into a great tourist place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I have no problem with those people.
Have you been to the wall in Washington?
Yeah, I've been there several times. Went there. It got to the point where after they, but now I didn't get to go to the dedication.
Mm-hmm.
For the wall, but I think 2 or 3 years later when they dedicated the statue, I went. But, right after they built the wall, probably within a year, I lived 10 hours away from D.C., and it got to the point where, oh, shoot, I bet 3 or 4 times a year, several of us vets around here, we'd pile in a car and just drive up there.
Mm-hmm.
And visit the wall. Yeah, it's a great monument. And my family, I've taken my family, taken in-laws and everybody else up there. And I love the place.
What have been your personal experiences there, just for you as a veteran?
Oh, it's emotional, but I don't I didn't break down, that's for sure. But. Some guys do, and I can understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I have no problem with that. That's just the way I am. It's a very, it's just great. It's almost reverent.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't have done it any better, I don't believe. They,
okay.
Just visiting is always quiet, and it's very, very respectful.
Mm-hmm.
And I know my wife took a little brownie troops up there one time. They flew up there just to visit D.C. and come back the same day, and they went to the wall. Because she always makes sure that, you do stuff like that, because
mm-hmm.
She's pretty well tuned in with me.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter and all his little girls, and his little girls are just in awe. They couldn't believe that many men had died.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the wall's a special place. Yeah, I've probably been there at least 10 times, if not more than that. Haven't been there lately, but I'll be going back.
Right. Do you think the U.S. government is taking care of its veterans, its Vietnam veterans particularly?
No, I don't think they take care of them very well at all.
Why not?
It seems like go back to Clinton. Clinton just screwed the VA something fierce. And the people they put in charge of the Veterans Affair were not veterans, and so they had no sympathy, and they pretty well leaned towards his feelings, which I understand that. You don't appoint people you don't like that you don't have any respect for. He had no respect whatsoever for veterans, it's that simple.
Mm-hmm.
He used them all the time, used the military all the time, but he had no respect mm-hmm. for the veterans. It still doesn't, for that matter. But no, I think the VA was suffered severely under Carter and and Clinton, and I'm not seeing a whole lot better out of George W., which surprised me, but it's still better than it was.
Mm-hmm.
At least the respect is back, and I think things will get better unless we get some anti-feelings in there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they do enough. No, I think they screw over the veterans for the most part.
Okay.
Now I've been treated okay, but I know a lot. I've got friends that work at the VA hospitals here, and they talk about the abysmal care that's given them some of the veterans. And most of those guys are World War II, and they deserve everything they can get.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, those guys deserve everything they can get, and they're not taken care of in the way they promised they would take care of vets.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So,
how do you think the Persian Gulf War, the first one, affected the memories of the Vietnam War? Do you think there was any kind of liberating feeling from that, or a justification or legitimizing of the military's power and strength and ability to actually win?
Oh, I think this latest one and the one in 91,
mm-hmm.
it definitely boosted the image of the military. Yeah, before that. Now, Reagan was great for us, but we never had any, I think what we do, going to Panama and Grenada, that wasn't any big, that wasn't anything big. And so, there wasn't any way we were going to lose on those.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a real challenge. But, these last two, it showed what the military could do, the American military, and I think it really helped, especially this last one. That was some actual combat. Now, the one in 91 was so short, the actual combat, it is almost a joke. radars, the whole thing collapsed. And so that didn't, it was almost, we thought it was funny. We couldn't believe it. $100 and the thing's over.
Mm-hmm.
But this last one showed that the military has really got its act together. Mm-hmm. So I think that I would hope most of the Americans, and I'm pretty sure most Americans feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it helped. It helped the image of the military.
Okay.
I really do.
Mr. Hargesheimer, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about or add to our conversations?
Not really. I mean, more than I've ever talked in my life at one stretch.
Right.
And I enjoyed it. I really did. I'm pleased that I got a chance to actually talk about it. But
Good. But, well, we appreciate your time very much.
Oh, well, you're welcome.
We'll go ahead and officially end the oral history interview with Mr. John Hargesheimer. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.